going to start today by showing you pictures, three of them, which have to do, which means that I have to backtrack a little. Namely, to show you three pictures about what we have talked about, the rediscovery of the body, the national stereotype, the male stereotype, how the sensuousness of the rediscovery of the body was overcome, because things were generalized, were made transparent. Can we have the first picture? I'd better not stand in the way, otherwise you confuse me with that little YouTube. Now this is the most famous picture ever of the German youth movement, which still exists, painted by a man called Thiers, who was a theosophic painter of the youth movement. Now, what I want to point out to you on that picture, which is about 1910, roughly, is, of course, this glorification of flaming youth. The youth is jumping into the universe. It is a typical kind of pantheistic thing, which I mentioned last time. He is a sun creature, that is to say, the sun is shining almost through him. His body is almost transparent. The stereotype, the blonde hair, and of course the modesty. All Fetus's nudes are painted from the back, for obvious reasons. So that it combines all of this and became a picture that went into the war, into the imagination of the volunteers, a picture which, in a way, exemplified the kind of picture the German youth movement, which you've read about in the culture of Western Europe, the idea the German youth movement had of itself, its idea of beauty and harmony and symmetry. You'll see some more later when I show you Rupert Brooke. But this is a kind of Rupert Brooke image, before Rupert Brooke. There is a lot here of Wagnerian ideas. That is to say, he's standing on a rock, he's about to jump, there is the universe. All that is missing is lightning, the thunder, and so on, that you have with it. Can we have the next one, Mary? Now, this, of course, became a symbol of the National Socialists. This is one of the statues in front of Hitler's Reichschancellery, sculptured by Arnold Brecker in 1939, a youth holding the sword, and you see again that the nudity is both Greek models, and, as we would say, abstracted. The stereotype is abstracted, it has become a symbol, there's very little sensuousness about it, and of course it holds not a gun but a sword, because, if I come back to it, the constant analogy of the war with chivalry. And that means that the symbol of modern war is the sword, and of course not the frightening gun. Could we have the next? This is another very famous one, called the Fighter, again of Hitler's Reichschancellery. Was also in Hitler's Reichschancellery at a very prominent place, also sculptured by Arno Brecker, chief Nazi sculptor of these kinds of things. I don't really have to say much more. It's really this kind of figure you can see on any kind of war memorial. I don't have any actual pictures to show you of war memorials of this nature, but if I had, you would see this kind of figure, young Siegfried, but young Siegfried in a Greek guise, of course, on a war memorial. The same kind of suggestion of blondness and suggestion of lightness that you have in that. Okay, Gary, that's enough for the moment. Now, what we have here then, in these three figures, which I wanted to show you first, is the kind of abstraction of unity that I tried to talk to you about. The idea that the sensuousness is taken by becoming sinful, by becoming light, transparent almost, that the light of the sun is as important as the symbol, which goes back to something I mentioned last time, the boy's bathing poem, or the image of soldiers bathing nude behind the front, which, as I told you last time, is the leading literary image of the war in Germany and England. But we must see, first of all, how the war was lifted into the sacred. And here I have already, before we see how it is trivialized, cut down to size, and here I already told you last time that the volunteers who rushed to the colors, the people who thought that this first Fidus picture, in a way, represented their idea of beauty, that these believed already that they were exceptional, that they were sacred, indeed made sacred, and indeed they were blessed in church early on in the war, then there were too many of them, blessed to church, that they connected this sacredness with the searching for an extraordinary experience, that they connected this sacredness with the festival, which is not surprising, with the search for personal rejuvenation, which was also, as I have told you, in search for national rejuvenation. And that search for national and personal rejuvenation of the volunteers was connected to the search for the extraordinary, for the festival, which is again symbolized by the blessing in church, at least them, if not them, then their flags. Now the center of the sacred was symbolized, no doubt, by the cult of the fallen soldier. That is to say, by the worst experience of the war, the coming in contact with mass death, which was certainly a novelty. None of the previous wars since Napoleon had this. And certainly in the trench warfare, you came across immediately with mass death. You sat on the dead, you trod on the dead were all around you. There was no way of getting them away from where you were. The result was the cult of the fallen soldier, not only the idea of camaraderie of death and life, which goes back again to the German Wars of Liberation and to the most famous German soldier song of all times, Uhland's "I had a comrade." I had a comrade and who falls and who death is a part of me. This most famous today at any time of all German soldier songs, "I had a comrade," symbolizes that the comrade in death is part of me in life. There is this in song as well. But above all, what you have really is a kind of Christian rhythm, of course, applied to it, because that is all the rhythm they knew. And in extreme situation, you always take recourse to religion, to safeguards, to the familiar, not to official religion. The chaplains were very unpopular in the war. It has nothing to do with official religion, with chaplains. It has a lot to do with the rhythm of Christianity, which everyone knew who fought the war. And in that rhythm of Christianity, you could, as it were, come to terms with mass death in the war. And the idea is, of course, rather simple, that the dead are not dead at all, but resurrected in order to spur the regeneration of the nation. Christian and national symbols combine, and they combine in the design of military cemetery. All right, Barry, here we go on to the next six pictures or so. Except the first. This is a fresco in the Hall of the Heroes of the biggest Italian military cemetery at Re Puglia, built, as a matter of fact, by the fascists in 1934. But though it was built by the fascists, it had the usual kind of theme. Here, it's made quite clear that the soldier is, as you can see, after all, literally resting in the lap of Christ, with the symbol of death, the barbed wire and the trenches in front. The next one. This is the cemetery of Re Puglia. And the Christian symbolism is still clearer if you see the three crosses of Calvary on the top of the cemetery. These are the famous three crosses of Calvary, which put the whole military cemetery under the symbol of Christianity, namely under the symbol of Calvary, under the symbol of death and resurrection. Next. This you can also get from Poland. This is a postcard from the Poland, from the Russian front in the First World War, by Poles. And here you have the same thing. Here the dead soldier is literally awakened by the figure of Christ to do his job, which is usually to lead to victory, to regenerate the nation. I shall come back to that in a minute. But here the soldier is literally awakened by Christ. The next one, please. Is another one, a German one, again the archangel gives him a flower, symbolizing the announcement of the archangel to the Virgin Mary of the coming resurrection. And this is what it says, actually. It is one of the many memorial volumes of the fallen, that is to say, the kind of leave you took to announce that your son had fallen to in the war, to relatives and others, sort of a death notice. And the head of this death notice is a direct reference to the archangel and the Virgin Mary at Bethlehem and the flower and the coming resurrection. Next one. Now, all military cemeteries are designed alike. The military cemeteries are all designed alike, and the British one, of which this is one, all over the world. They were designed by the British War Commission in 1917. And when the British War Commission, British War Graves Commission designed these British military cemeteries, it designed them symbolically. The soldiers rest between two things, the cross of resurrection and the stone of remembrance, or the altar of sacrifice. The cross of resurrection, well, look at it closely, you can see an iron cross in the other cross. The iron cross is a symbol not only of Germany, but a symbol of all warring nations, of special courage. The iron cross within the cross, and before that the stone of sacrifice. The stone of sacrifice which had a line from Kipling on it. They shall be remembered forevermore. Kipling's own son fell early on in the war, and Kipling was a driving force in the war, a Graves Commission. This stone has a double symbolic function, and you will find it in every military cemetery of all nations, as you will the cross in one form or another. The function of the stone is, first of all, to represent the fatherland through something massive, boulder-like, something that cannot be moved. In Germany, they are usually uncut stones. And secondly, of course, reminiscence of the Christian altar, so that the dead lie between the cross of the sacrifice and the altar of a resurrection, the headstones here at the left. Moreover, the national military cemeteries point back to Arcadia. I've told you last time, and I talked about Rupert Brooke, the bathing scenes and the fields, how in the middle of the war, the longing for Arcadia became extremely strong. And military cemeteries point back to Arcadia. For Arcadia comes to stand for hope, for the nation, for peace. In England, this meant the flowers, and it meant literally that the cross of sacrifice is a copy of crosses in English village churches. These are the crosses that you will see in the English countryside, in the English village church. The flowers you will see here are the more common English flowers. Last time I read you the poem by Rupert Brooke about the flowers and cleanliness. Now in Germany it is different, and I'm not able to show you a picture of the one new kind of cemetery. You can turn this off for a minute. One kind of new cemetery that came about in the war, which is called the Hero's Wood. This cemetery used the graves of the dead with pine tree, the German national symbol, and these were cemeteries which were put in woods, symbolizing the closeness of the dead to nature and to the rhythm of nature. It's again a rhythm of death and resurrection, winter and summer, of the German symbol of the German wood. and the German dream, and it also served again to disguise death, because there's a long history, which I won't bother you with, park cemeteries. It's actually an American movement of park cemeteries which came to Munich, into Germany. The Munich Park Cemetery is the most famous. But the thing about park cemeteries is that you cannot see the graves, that the woods disguise the grave. You can be in Munich, Waldfriedhof Park Cemetery, which was designed in 1910, and you don't see a tomb. The landscape disguises it. And similarly, this was used in the war, not only by Germany, but also by Italy, to combine really three things: the national symbol of the tree, the idea of nature and Arcadia and innocence, and thirdly, really, the idea of disguising death, using nature to disguise death. Now, that is true in all military cemeteries, because they are orderly. And order disguises death. Order disguises death. But here, death is literally disguised by the wood. And it was hoped that these woods would become, in fact, national pilgrimage places. In the wood, there was a stone of remembrance, a cross of sacrifice, and a path between them that is usually called the holy path, or the pilgrimage path, a very typical thing. At times, every tree got the name of a soldier. Every soldier got his own tree to really symbolize resurrection, to really symbolize that he would never die. And you can see this in the German hero's words. And if you ever come to Rome, in the Parioli district of Rome, there's a similar one where every soldier has, where every tree has the name of a soldier. These are hero's words. But in nations of which flowers are more symbolic, like France and England, there are, of course, no hero's woods. There are instead a riot of flowers. Can I have the next please? There are instead a riot of flowers, as you can see in this one. In this one, which is actually a British military cemetery in the battlefield. Now, many of these cemeteries were first erected during the battle. You had to do something with all these corpses. And when you could, you erected them with wooden crosses. Now, these wooden crosses were, after the war, replaced by headstones. But it shows you again the sacredness. As the problem came up, what to do with the temporary wooden crosses, which you had to take out. The bodies were taken and were coordinated in military cemeteries. But the landscape of the battle was dotted at first with these little cemeteries, like this one. This is the British one, the Battle of the Somme. What do you do with the crosses? Well, the crosses were treated, in fact, as sacred crosses. For a while, the relatives could send for the cross, and it would be sent to the relatives free of charge by the War Graves Commission of every country. But eventually, of course, it was a problem for the relatives, because what were you to do with such a big cross in the home? So it came up, and eventually these crosses were taken to a church and burnt in church, like the Easter fire. Now, if you're familiar with Christian liturgy, in Easter there is the Easter fire, symbolist of the resurrection in Catholic churches. But this time this was generally adopted first for the Australian dead, because it was more expensive to ship them to Australia, but then for everyone else. And the crosses were taken, these crosses were taken and burned in the churches when the headstones came up. Again, an idea of the sacredness of it all. Could I have the next, please? No, don't want that yet. Okay. Now, what we have here then is that the soldiers never die. And they never die is clear after the war, when, especially in the defeated, but not in the victorious nations, the cult of the living, never-dead soldier becomes very active, even in the German Republic. A preface to a catalogue of German war monuments, for example, says that the dead come and visit you at night to exhort you to revenge the fatherless. But they can do other things I'm just thinking in my head of the memorial book of the Westphalian Fire Brigade, for example. So in Oklahoma, the Fire Hall of Fame. Let's say the Westphalian Fire Brigades in their memorial book, yes, for their fallen, say that we are, these fallen will return to stop us from becoming part of the mass, to keep us individualists. In other words, there's always this this point against industrial society. As I told you already, there was this dispute whether the common headstone should be mass manufactured. And then in Germany, in fact, the common iron crosses were done by hand, all the millions, as a symbol against industrialization, keeping back. As I told you, the English had a kind of mixture. The headstones were actually mass-produced, but the individual inscriptions and the similar badges of the regiments were all done by hand. Now, it must be clear, then, that here you have in the military cemetery, really all these ideas of the volunteers, all these ideas that the soldiers never die, all these ideas what makes a death actually meaningful. And all this was immediately connected to the idea of camaraderie. The camaraderie of the nation. The camaraderie and of comrades. Can I have the next one? And so the main festival in the trenches was War Christmas. Can I have one? Now this is a postcard. I shall come back to postcards later, films and so on. But this is War Christmas. Now, I want to point out to you several things about this postcard, which is a postcard that would be sent home from the front, the German front in this case, but not so much different, as Christmas greetings to the family. Now you notice, first of all, of course, there is a certain glorification, which we will see. The dugout is actually quite comfortable. There is the emphasis, as in all religious festival, on food. To eat well. He has before him some actually cooking food, which of course never happened in a dugout. You can perhaps understand that. And a stove, which was never in a dugout. In the dugout you got trench feet and so on, because they didn't have stove. In other words, I'll show you many more postcards later. But it is, again, pointing home, making clear that War Christmas is really something that points to the home, points to a kind of archive. You see the Christmas tree in the back, and you see the soldier writing his Christmas greeting or whatever you have, yes, and on his wall a patriotic picture, which is a picture of Hindenburg, with his commander-in-chief, which you can't quite see, no loss. Anyhow, now, what I want to point out to that is that the high command were quite aware of the danger of War Christmas. And that danger was not made clear in the first Christmas in 1914, when something happened that put the fear of God into the high command, fraternization. Towards midnight, as you know this, many of you, in 1914 Christmas, German, French, and English soldiers all left their trenches and had a Christmas party in no man's land and fraternized. This very famous thing was, of course, punished with death from then on in, and there were very strict rules against it. And therefore, typically enough, from then on in France, England, and Germany, at any rate, the Christmas sermon, which the officer had to give to his man, his squad, in the dugout, was very rigidly fixed. But the sermon has three parts to it. One, Christmas, a lovely feast of peace. But peace can only come, be won by war and rejuvenation. And finally, Christmas was transformed into a memorial service for the fallen comrades, which was very true, because that pointed, of course, to war rather than to peace in a more profound Christian way. So this is the famous War Christmas, which was the chief festival of the trenches. Very dangerous festival. First, as I say, fraternization. But since 1914, no more fraternization at all. All right, thank you. Now in all this, the idea of camaraderie is obviously quite clear. And it is again connected to the officer, to the hero, to the volunteer. And I must come back to that slightly different in a minute, to the stereotype of Rupert Brooke in England, of Vauche in France, who died in the war, but who became a part of every soldier who didn't really die. And not only that, who symbolized the camaraderie and the kind of officers the volunteers wanted to be. I shall come back to that. But again, perhaps in this we should have, could we have the next picture? We should look at the picture of Rupert Brooke now for a minute, the famous picture which accompanies the edition of his poems of 1918 and the memoir about Rupert Brooke by Augie Marsh, which really founded the myth of Rupert Brooke. And this picture of the stereotype, perhaps you should see it in your mind in connection with that German youth movement figure of Fidos that I showed you. He is also blonde, he is also transparent, he is also fragile and innocent, this figure. Of symmetric features, as after all Winston Churchill said in his obituary. He sort of points back to Arcadia in his innocence. This picture has a history. It was withdrawn because Brooke's mother was afraid that it was too obviously homoerotic. And it only came back in later editions in the 1920s, this picture of Rupert Brooke. But it is the picture, I think, that has gone into the mythology of Rupert Brooke, a mythology which you should now be quite clear. Thank you. Now, this idea of innocence and honor is projected on the greatest of the wartime experience, wartime camaraderie. Now, this again, of course, had a long history, the longing for comradeship, of affinity, not comradeship of impulse, of the German youth movement, but of France, the equivalent as well of the generation of 1914. That nationalism allowed them to express their individuality and yet live among comrades. The great ideal of these young Frenchmen before 1914, of the German youth movement, the young Italians, and all of these, that you wanted to be an individual and yet live among comrades. And this idea of nationalism as a camaraderie of affinity was partly what had made them volunteer. The rejuvenation in their comradeship, which would come from the cement of a shared past, a shared enthusiasm, a shared nationalism, living among comrades. And already before 1914, this ideal saw itself surrounded by enemies without and within. Camaraderie was already exalted as the true national community, which is beleaguered on all sides. It became tied up to the idea of the dead and to the idea of Greek beauty. It became idea tied up to the idea of death. It's easy to explain through the chorus of the Hitler Youth on Memorial Day, which sums it up, Memorial Day, which was celebrated as part of the Nuremberg Party Day. The Hitler Youth, 10,000, 12,000, said as follows: the best of our people did not die, that the living might die, but that the dead might come alive. In other words, this is very typically summed it up. The camaraderie of the nation, and Hitler and Goebbels always said, we put our conquest on the altar of the dead, on this altar that I just showed you, on the altar of the dead. The best of our people did not die, that the living might die, but that the dead might come alive. And there was a ceremony both in France, England, Italy, and Germany, by which the role of the dead was called. a live soldier said present. This was adopted, by the way, if you've seen that very good film, you should see The War at Home about the riots in Madison. This was adopted by the resistors against the Vietnam War as a kind of anti-war thing. But in its origin, it's of course a cult of the fallen soldier, if you like, pro-war thing, to call up the names of the dead and have every soldier say present. It brings it that the dead are not dead at all. They live on. And they live on, of course, how? In the camaraderie of the nation. They live on as part of this camaraderie, which transmits it. As I told you, to this day, the Australian veterans, when they make their pilgrimage to Gallipoli, stop by at Mykonos, the Greek island where Rupert Brooke is buried. There are now national war heroes to whose tomb you make a pilgrimage. There is such in Italy, and there was, of course, Walter Flex's tomb in a hero's wood, by the way. Walter Flex's tomb in a hero's wood still exists today in Germany. It became a youth hospital. It's very typical that when they thought, what were they going to do to honor Walter Flex in his hero wood, besides the cross and the stone of remembrance, at the edge of this hero's wood, it still exists, they constructed a youth hospital. Again, bringing all this camaraderie innocence in contact with flaming youth, quite literally, of course, couldn't do this on the island of Mykonos. This camaraderie also strengthened a democratic ideal of leadership. Now this becomes extremely important when all of this becomes a powerful political force after the war. Camaraderie and leadership of affinity go together. And that has a very long tradition. In the Napoleonic Wars, the volunteers elected their officers, both in the volunteer army of the French Revolution and, in a sense, even in the armies of national liberation against the French Revolution, the volunteers elected their officers. So that there was a tradition here of a kind of closeness between officer and man. A kind of closeness between officer and man, which you have. For what was the officer to be? And remember, it is the volunteers who create the myth. Remember, it's the officers who create the myth themselves. As Donald Hankey puts it in England, in his book about volunteers in the war, a man of finer temper than ourselves, a tough, as he puts it. Or as the German youth movement and the German soldiers then put it, he must have what Max Weber called charisma. He must demonstrate leadership. Now, there is a very important problem involved. We do not know, of course, at all what camaraderie meant to the people who fought in the trenches. There are no surveys which tell what did it mean to you while you fought this camaraderie in the trenches. The nearest we come to it is a French survey, which is only of 425 veterans out of many millions, so it's almost unvalid statistically. But it is clear that the fighting in the trenches became, in the end, a job, a kind of fatalistic duty, and that certainly by 1916 and 17, the patriotic tones were quite absent, that it was a kind of fatalism, which the peasant had anyhow, a fatalistic religion transferred to the trenches of doing your duties after all the threat of not doing your duties was death as well, don't forget. So you have it in this way, and you have, of course, mutiny, the famous French mutiny before Verdun in 1917, which nearly defeated France. And there were many small mutinies among the troops as the war went on. So we don't know what it really meant at all. But it is the myth that is again important. And the myth, of course, was made by these officers and these volunteers and was accepted after the war even by people who should know better. Because, as I told you last time, they had to come to terms with their experience. and coming to terms with their experience meant accepting the myth of camaraderie, even if they fought with indifference. After the war, it became, in fact, a myth. To a very good extent, this can be illustrated at its most extreme. Perhaps the truest portrait of a squad in the trenches is by the Frenchman Henri Barbusse, called Under Fire, which you know as the really main anti-war novel. And Henri Barbusse, of course, after the war, joined the Communist Party. But it is typical that when Henri Barbusse came to found a veterans organization of French veterans, he excluded everyone except frontline soldiers. So that in spite of communism and in spite of the squad and in spite of the realists, in the end Barbusse confessed that there was something about frontline soldiers that made them better comrades than any other kind of soldier. Even in Barbusse, the author of Under Fire, the frontline soldier is in the end glorified. Comradeship is glorified, not in his novel of 1917, but it is glorified once the war is over. That's very typical. In his novel, you won't find it glorified in 1916. But when the war is over, he glorifies it. We have many ideas. One of the chief soldier veterans who glorified camaraderie in Germany, who wrote many books, a man called Schaubecker. We knew that he had a tough time among his comrades. He was a little runt, he had glasses and so on. He was much teased by his comrades, yes? But after the war, he, the little runt who was teased by his comrades, and who was very cowardly, became the greatest myth-maker about the camaraderie of the war, and his novels became the greatest of this kind, Mum of the Great. Now, the camaraderie goes together with ideas of equality. The ideas of equality which are extremely important. I'm quite aware that in reality many of the second lieutenants were shot in the back by their men. There's no doubt that that happened a lot. But the myth took, of course, the opposite course. As one German memoir puts it, equality established itself naturally. I'm sorry, as one French observer puts it, equality established itself naturally. The idea of camaraderie was joined to the equality of status, not function. That is very important for the future. Indeed, an Italian tells us how the war was a judgment of God, but how, in the end, his loneliness was mitigated by camaraderie and by his officer whom he called not only a great leader, but beautiful to look at as well. So that you get, even from this Italian peasant, and from many others, certainly believe me about that, this idea of the officer. The officer is the natural leader, both in good looks and in qualities. The fault line solidarity between officers and men. And that solidarity directed, as indeed it was, against the base and the home front. This was not a class war. A new class was born. And I cite this from the Communist Barbusse, no less. A new class war was born. The war of the frontline soldiers against the rest of society, whom he thought had betrayed him. The home front and the base, the general staff at the base. The war against these, that was the new war. And of course, there's a great deal of truth to it, because after the war, you cannot understand post-war politics without understanding that. That in the end, the great attraction in the defeated nations, in Italy, in Germany, for the idea of camaraderie, for a new idea of leadership based on democracy, which had become alive in the war, which had become alive in the war. And unlike socialist leaders, most fascist leaders were frontline officers and fought in the front line. So that, in a sense, fascism, but not only for fascism, this idea of camaraderie was once more replayed, if you like, the equality between officers and men, between frontline soldiers and the home front. the idea of a charismatic and democratic leadership. This is very important. The unity, the democracy, which can be illustrated from a vast number of novels in all countries, which I think I will spare you, together with all the emphasis on youth and all of that. For example, Walter Flex's friend Borsche was a true leader. He led by example. He led by this democratic theory of leadership, which was also the theory of leadership in the youth movement before the war, by being a little bit better, a little bit more courageous, a little bit better than everybody else. Not better in an inherited sense. This has nothing to do with inheritance. It is against inheritance. It is a natural leadership. A little bit better, a little bit better, good looking, a little bit more honest, a little bit more modest. As one Italian soldier again described his captain, as young, tall, and good, symbolizing all national virtues. Or as an English cockney described his officer in his diary, there was something religious about his care for our feet. It seemed to have a touch of Christ about it. Interesting remark, because again, it brings the reality of the war, trench feet. A good officer would be concerned for his feet of his men. That was the chief problem you had in the trenches, was trench feet. The feet of your men were your chief problem, and you had to see that they were as dry as possible and that they were changed as possible, their footwear and all of this. And here, this simple cockney brings it immediately in touch with Christ, with Christ's washing of the feet. Again, you have this sort of thing coming together, this authoritarian leadership, which was, after all, part of wartime camaraderie. And as such, it was projected upon the post-war world, doing, I think, little harm in England and France, and doing a great deal of harm in Germany and Italy and Eastern Europe, doing relatively little harm in the victorious nation, who had no cycle of revolution and counter-revolution, and doing a great deal of harm, of course, in those nations which thought itself betrayed, defeated, which had a cycle of revolution and counter-revolution and civil war. Germany, Italy, Eastern Europe, there this myth did a great deal of harm. In England and France, where it certainly existed, and existed very strongly, it did a very little harm. It still exists in Australia, of course, which is sort of the England of the 1930s, when Australia stood still. In that very strong expression, it'll be all right, mate. Whatever happens in Australia, the constant strikes, you miss your airplane, there are no trains, there's no food, there's no water, there's no heat. The answer is standard. It'll be all right, mate. And the idea, mate, is of course a term from the war. Well, much of our vocabulary of camaraderie comes from the war, by the way. I should say a little more later about wartime vocabulary, because that's very important. We think as we speak. But the idea of mate is, of course, a trench vocabulary, a vocabulary that comes from this idea of camaraderie. Again, what comes out of that, therefore, is, if I could put it that way, an idea of male camaraderie, which I can sum up again with the most famous, I think probably apart from Flex, the most famous book to come out of the German side of the war, Otto Braun's so-called Memoirs of One Who Died Early. The memoirs I have fully lended him. Otto Braun, by the way, the son of the famous socialist feminist, Lilly Braun, who was one of the first socialist feminists Germany, started the German feminist movement. Her son, Otto Braun, who was killed very early on in the war and who was a genius and so on, and a sort of Rupert Brooke. In fact, you might say Otto Braun is the most living Rupert Brooke in Germany. And Otto Braun read in his immensely popular book, which you can still read today, which summed it all up in a sense, war became our higher faith, so that the body in our nervous age becomes steeled, serious, mature, and let latent with all the glorious deeds of the future and their manly beauty. And here you have really it all summed up in a way of the war. The higher faith, the body, the nervous age. This counters the nervous age as the idea in the military cemetery, as the idea of innocent, of the hero's wood, or what they call in France the jardin funèbre, the flowers in the cemetery, the garden of flowers in the cemetery, the camaraderie, a war Christmas. All of this comes in this kind of idea. And all of this has, of course, to be stripped of sensuousness and homoeroticism. As Rupert Brooke wrote, camaraderie is always exciting and always safe. There is no lust in it, and therefore no poison. It is cleaner than love and older. Purity is always a part of this. Please do not forget. Purity is always a part of it. The purity symbolized by Christ awakening the fallen soldier, who is by definition pure. Purity in the German trees of Germany, the German wood. Purity in the English flower, in the country churchyard, from which you have the cross of sacrifice, which I have just shown you. A purity in the figure of Wotan and Rupert Brooke, in the vulnerability, in the kind of back to Arcadia innocence, which I hope made it clear to you. All of this is a camaraderie of men, and it is as such a camaraderie that fascism presented itself all over Europe. The Nazi Party, quite consciously, as a camaraderie of men, the Italians too, but not only fascist parties. Many other political parties that are between the wars try to catch up this elan of a mere camaraderie, which in a time of revolution and counter-revolution meant just what Otto Braun said, the stealing against the nervous age. The stealing against the nervous age. That mere friendship must be put above the relationship between men and women. That male dominance, I'll begin next time, that male dominance is built into that, even in the pictures of the war. And I will continue a little bit, but let me make two remarks then, and that's what I shall do next time. There's a great deal more pictures than I showed you today. To continue the serious and sacred, and then go to the trivialization process of postcards and film and food.